and welcome to part two of this CityWire podcast in association with Prudential. I'm your host, Ashley Thomas-Walsh, Audience Development Manager of New Moral Advisor. Alongside me is Les Cameron, Head of Technical at Prudential, and Kevin Forbes, Partner of Strategic Solutions. In this three-part series, we'll be exploring intergenerational wealth and the things advisors can do to facilitate better transitions of wealth between multiple generations. This is episode two, and our topic is what is stopping the transfer of wealth besides a lack of financial advice. Now, we'll be referring to the Prudential Wealth Unlocked report again. 29% of their sample, when asked about concerns about gifting early, said they were hesitant as they might need the money for themselves in the future. Additionally, 25% said they were concerned that the younger generations would squander their hard-earned savings. So let's explore this a little bit more.
So, yeah, I think most people tend to fall into two categories, either savers or spenders. And I think that's quite a generational change between that as well. So I think older generations tend to be very much on the savers side. So I think a lot of the reason they wait so long is because they are overcautious about what assets they've got. So I think we've seen that with some of the pension freedom stuff as well, that everybody thought that everybody run out and buy that Lamborghini on day one and blow their pension. And certainly some people have, but most clients is actually more about trying to relax them more and be not quite as cautious and to spend their money. So I think one of the biggest issues why they wait so long is because they think they've got past the point where they might need all that cash. So I think being over cautious is a huge part of that situation. I also think that most people feel wealthy when their property is valued higher and it's in such illiquid assets as well. So I think that, you know, the most wealth in the country really for normal people would be around property based and pension based. So I guess you tend to build those up more and more as you go on and later, and then they're probably the least flexible as well.
Yeah, so you're saying what the most typical concern is basically, yeah, having that more money than they actually need, saving a lot, the kind of older generation. Les, is this kind of similar to what you've seen?
Yeah, definitely. I think I call it reckless prudence, which can be just as dangerous to your wealth as kind of reckless investments. You're being too cautious. I think there is that. There is the element of I might need the money. But then there's also the sort of the possibly more traditional point about, well, I had to make my own way in the world. I had to work hard for everything I've got. I'm just not going to put everything on the plate for my children. So whilst there's I might need the money, and there's the overcautiousness of that, and I think that comes through in the Family Wealth Unlocked report was one of the key things. I might need the money myself. The other one was, well, I would gift it if I didn't think the family were going to squander it, or the family would start to get lazy and not make their own way in the world. So there's that kind of control over spending element as well. Kevin picked up the point about residential property, and obviously that is quite a big part of people's estates. But I was actually looking at the IHT stats from yesterday for a presentation I was doing. You would probably be amazed to find that about half of the composition of estates that paid the average IHT bill, which is a touch under £180,000, was either in cash, stocks and shares, or life assurance policies that weren't under trust. So I think there is definitely the rise in property values will undoubtedly rise the estates, but a lot of the composition of estates is stuff that could reasonably easily be done with the help of a financial advisor, getting that out of the estate. And I suppose that the skill of the financial advisor is being able to take those things people care about and giving them solutions to that. Like, it's quite easy to set up trusts. You can still gift the money away, but you get to control who gets it, when they get it. You could even control what it's spent on. So I think the key thing is to get the people starting to think more about how much they can give away. You can give away different levels depending on the different types of trusts you use and all that sort of thing. But that's when the financial advisor needs to get to the bottom of their fears, squandering. They need to make their own way in the world. And then say, well, do you realise you can do this? Do you realise you can do that? Because the thing with these people is they don't realise you can do this and they don't realise you can do that.
Yeah. I also think the natural byproduct of the client or the grandparent or the parent being older is that the child or the grandchild is older as well. So they see him as being maybe a little bit more sensible and also more stable. So some issues we have are, you know, less and less people get married now than ever before anyway. But those that do, higher and higher numbers get divorced. So, you know, if it's a lopsided situation where one set of parents has got a lot more money than the other and gives it to them and pays off a mortgage or does anything, then if they end up, which is a probability that they'll split up or get divorced, then they're worried about who gets that cash. So that's when Les's point about trust and stuff is so important. It's the way to do it, but it won't help necessarily pay off a mortgage or those sorts of things.
Yeah,
because absolutely. So I think that's when you know, it's important that financial planners link up with lawyers and stuff, and if they do gift money away, you know, make sure they gift it to the right person and have a legal agreement that if on a split, or you know, they'll change the way the house is owned and stuff like that. So which is always an uncomfortable conversation, because as with everything, clients always say, oh no, my son-in-law, my daughter-in-law's lovely. They would never do that. They'd never split up. And, you know, nobody gets married thinking they're going to get divorced, but over two-thirds of them do now. So
I think some of them probably don't realise they've been making gifts. In the report, it says a lot of them had given their children money to go back to university, to start a business, to pay a house deposit. You've made a gift for IHD purposes if you give somebody 50 grand for their house deposit. And if you die within 7 years, that may or may not cause them tax sort of thing. So they just don't understand. They're just going about their normal family life and doing what families do. But in tax terms, they're doing quite a lot, which you need a professional to help you with.
So it sounds like education is quite important in that sense then, when it comes to the trust gifting, finding out what actually is a gift and letting them know that they might actually be doing it already and what they can actually do and what they can do to mitigate the risk of the money going elsewhere or somewhere they didn't intend.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that comes through in the report. I think most advisors will understand the type of things, the common themes people are concerned about with giving their money away and making gifts and all that sort of thing. And I think those concerns are largely well known and they've always been the same, and that's been reflected in the results in the report, and it's just putting it to ease. You think that, but did you know this? You think that, but did you know this? And then you can move along there. When you start those conversations, I don't know. I'm not sure you do it in day one, the first time you meet them, but maybe as you establish a relationship with them and maybe get a fuller picture of their family circumstances, which will be changing as grandchildren come in and brothers and sisters go out and people leave uni, people start uni, the kind of intergenerational dynamics constantly changing. So there will come a point where moving the money on is going to become kind of a higher priority than themselves.
Yeah, you tied it into my next question there, Nancy, which was talking about when how to challenge these views. So when to start the discussion? You're saying not on day one. So do you think it's essential to almost build that separate client rapport first before you start talking about bringing in the wider family?
So I think about it as myself or my parents. It's just gently questioning and understanding. There'll be something stopping them doing something, and I think a lot of the time what's stopping them doing it will be a lack of information and how they can do it in the way they'd actually like to do it, and they don't know they can do that, and that's where the advisor comes in. But I suspect it is later on in the relationship, because maybe when you first pick up somebody, they're maybe in their mid-30s, mid-40s, they're concerned about their retirement, they're concerned about maybe finally paying off the mortgage and these sort of things. And
yeah, I agree in that. Yeah, we're a chartered firm, and we really strongly believe in qualifications and knowledge and learning. But being a financial planner is not a science; it's an art as well. What that is the empathy and the understanding. So, you have to build that up, build the knowledge of the household up and the wider family before you go sort of charging in, because they won't do anything unless they've got 100% confidence and trust in what you're saying. So, if I walk in on day one, and start saying you need to give this kid 100 grand or this trust or this or the other, they'll just think, oh, not sure. So it's definitely a slow process to let them have confidence in what you're doing for them, and the planning you're doing for them means they will be okay. When they trust you enough to think, okay, he said I'm okay with this much money and this much income, then they'll trust you enough to say, right, so now what we need to do is the intergenerational piece, or the passing the money down. But if you went in on day one and said, oh, don't worry about it, you've got £500,000 too much cash, give it to your kids, it's a big decision for them to make when they don't know anything about you. You might touch on it and explain these will be the things you'll be looking at later, but they have to, you know, they most people choose you as an advisor because they have confidence in you. And also certain life, you know, if you've been an advisor for a long time, things will happen. They'll pay off their mortgage and they've got more spare cash. So they'll retire. They might have a lump sum if it's a final salary scheme or you know, suddenly things, there's a big things that happen in their lives and there's big things that happen in the lives of people, the rest of their family. So if you've been a good trusted advisor and those things happen, they become the right opportunity to say, right, okay, let's sort this out.
Kevin, we were having a chat before this podcast started and you were mentioning kind of getting to know clients and how they might have different values, and you can tell that by, say, entering their house, you know, seeing what's important to them as you get to know them. Does this kind of come hand in hand with that? Would you understand one client, maybe they want to talk about this a lot sooner, kind of you can tell it's going to be on their mind, you can tell they're family orientated, whereas another one, you think this is one, yeah, as you kind of say, you softly mention, you drop into the chat, but you don't really bring it up as a real topic until much later down the line of the relationship?
Yeah, 100%. So the answer for two sets of people might be that you need to give some money away to reduce your IHT bill or to whatever. But the motivation why they want to do that might be completely different. So, you know, one might want to do it because it's tax efficient and they don't want the tax man to have the money. And others might do it because they want to help the family. So it's all about them. Anything we do, any decision we make in any way is all about you know, the motivational reasons for doing that. So, and you do get that. The better you know a client, the more time you've known them, and the more effort you put into it, then that becomes obvious. But you can see stuff when it's hard on Zoom because we've all got a big fake bookshelf of really clever books in the background that makes us look clever. That's not true. But when you walk into somebody's house, you get a feeling of a family-orientated house or a business-orientated house or so on. And you can tell, you know, by looking at their walls, if they've got 500 pictures of children and grandchildren and stuff like that, that's their main priority in life. Whereas if they've got, you know, a minimalist house and you know, they might not be the same. You definitely can't just assume that either, but you do get a good idea. So I think it's matching the reasons for doing stuff with what the best planning is to do as well. So it's no good just telling people you should do this. No. They need to know why, don't they? We're all the same with everything.
Yeah, I think, I was told when I was very first trained many years ago, people have got needs, gots and wants. And you can tell them, well, you've got a need for protection or you've got a need for IHT planning, you've got a need for this, you've got a need for that, because you see like the hard facts of the person. Well, if your estate's that size, you've got an IHT bill. But they also want, they need to want to reduce their IHT bill. They need to want to give their money away, or they might want to give their money away, but in a certain style sort of thing. So customer outcome is fundamentally key. What are you trying to achieve and why are you trying to achieve it? Because I think intergenerational can be about tax, but it can just be about moving the money to the right people at the right time, and tax isn't even a consideration. Because if you're wanting to save up to help your child go to university or your grandchild go to university, that's the driver. The fact that you can do IHT efficiency is kind of like an added bonus. It's wanting to do things and then getting the advisor to help you do them in the way that's better for everybody.
Yeah, so again, it's kind of about finding out what's going to suit the client best early on, as Kevin was saying. We have talked a bit about the personal side of it, whether you want to kind of give the money early to kids and grandkids, but just focusing on IHT a bit more there, are there being a lot of opportunities being missed at the moment, in your opinion?
I think so, yeah. Sorry. Going back to those stats I was looking at the other day. I think it was Roy Jenkins said back in the 80s, inheritance tax is for people who distrust their heirs more than they dislike the revenue. What he was basically alluding to is it's largely a voluntary tax because there's so much easy things you can do to get rid of it. So receipts have been rising and the amounts of estates that are paying IHT are rising. So I can't see that it's anything other than a lack of inheritance tax planning is making the bills continue to rise. So,
yeah. And Kevin, in practice, is this one of the things that you directly talk to clients about? As kind of Les alluded to there, in the opposite way, some may want to gift a child to go to university and they get IHC saved, whereas some might do it the opposite way, whereas they wouldn't actually donate before. But now, because you've explained the risk, the amount they could lose, they're actually more keen to donate and gift.
Yeah, and it's inheritance tax is something that's still not widely understood at all by the general public, apart from the super rich people who've avoided paying it since they inherited their land in 1066 or something. Yeah. I think it's also quite a big difference in sort of geography as well. So there still is a far more illiquid wealth in London and the southeast, and even stretching across to a bit of the southwest now, which causes, you know, different issues and for planning as well. But there are still things, of course, that you can do. But you know, if most of your wealth is, like we find down in, you know, like I said, the south, is tied up in illiquid assets, it's quite hard to give some of that away. You can skim the stuff off the top, but quite often that's the only thing they've got.
Yeah.
I think giving advice is also quite tricky in certain areas. So there's been a lot of talk about equity release, relieving that problem. I think, IHT it's lovely when you meet a client who's got an IHT problem and most of it is liquid, because you can solve it quite simply. But I think it's not necessarily talked about in here, and we've got to be careful how you talk about this. But also the massive elephant in the room is not always the IHT side. It's the long-term care side as well, and paying for your later life care, which can you know, reduce your size of your estate and evaporate your wealth way quicker than a married couple with a main residence relief on for inheritance tax. So it's hand in hand as well, really.
Yeah, I think that kind of ties back into that. I might need it. You might need it for your care, and you need to get a significant size of wealth before you can start thinking about, well, I could probably afford 10 years of care now, and I'll still get extra. I think the other thing, obviously, is if you've got a liquid assets or whatever, you could just do some life assurance and insure the liability. I kind of call it paying your tax in installments. So just do a life assurance policy. But the point generally about being earlier, in pure tax terms, the earlier the better, because you get annual gifting allowances. I was speaking to an advisor of somebody in the state of just over £9 million, and they were quite happy not doing any IHT planning because the kids would get by on the £5.6 million that they were left with. He had started with next to nothing sort of thing. So that kind of drags you back down to the kind of wanting to do something about it as well. He was more interested in the money going to them at the right time, and he wasn't obviously too worried about inheritance tax. He just made sure his will split the properties between the son and daughter and the way he wanted it to go. And the IHT was a secondary consideration. But the earlier the better. But all those issues about it might be too early to give away, I don't want to give them the money, I might need my money, the earlier you start, that'll kind of elevate the importance of all those sort of things that make them reticent to give money away, I think.
Have you had a kind of best example, best case of IHT mitigation working? A client situation, Joe, that's worked out best, even if it's actually avoiding it, like Les has just given the example of?
Yes. I don't know if there's a best case, because everything is so individual to the individual household or person. We've done some decent stuff, of course, but everyone's different. And this is where a lot of problems we get as advisors and planners, as a profession, come in, is that the regulator and something that's becoming more and more pertinent to us is the professional indemnity insurance. They make all their rules on a massive top-down basis. So they don't like to admit it, and they say they're outcomes-based, but they're not. We meet the people, find out exactly what's best for them. And that there's always a clash between, you know, what's right for the individual and very specific to what is the big sweeping rule that we've had imposed on us from above. So really hard to say a great bit of advice, but it does usually involve trust work and that stuff, really, and liquid assets. Sometimes changing the way that the homes are structured and stuff as well, the main residence to use that. that tends to be more long-term care than inheritance tax-based, but it's also so closely linked in that.
Yeah, I've got a couple of scenarios. When we were allowed to go out and go and have dinner with advisors and hear their tales, etc. There was one, he was saying they basically weren't willing to give their money away because they might need it, the traditional one. And they had more money than they were going to need. And then I said, well, did you just ask them about giving away their growth? Because there's certain types of arrangements where the growth is out your estate immediately to your beneficiaries and you keep access to your original capital. It's called a loan trust. And why would that help? Is that, well, they've got an attachment to the capital they've built up. They might not have a psychological attachment to the growth in that money because they kind of, as long as they've got access to their original amount. And he emailed me a few weeks later to say he'd been back to discuss it and perfectly happy to give away the growth in their capital. Immediately outside their estate, if you've got a large amount of money, that can be tens of thousands of pounds of tax, sort of thing, just by getting your growth out.
Brilliant. Well, it definitely sounds like there's obviously an individual case for each kind of client and different kind of things that you need to work out with them. Relationship with money being one of them, which kind of brings me on to the next point. Kind of focusing on the kind of traditional values and taboos around money, do you think they're prudent or do you actually think they're a bit of a hindrance when discussing with clients and why?
We've done a fair amount of research about these sort of things over time. I think you get different people, don't you, that are completely open about their finances and that's obviously healthy because you understand who's got what and what you might get. And then there's people that won't even discuss it with their spouse.
Yeah.
People that are quite happy discussing it with their spouse, but we can't let the children know about anything like this. And if you are looking at intergenerational planning, having a decent picture of the different generations is obviously crucial, I think. The more information you share with each other and allow it to be shared with the advisor, I think the better job can be done. So I think it's I'm sure Kevin would probably say it's definitely a hindrance. But one of the key things on our Unlocked Wealth report was some of them were resistant to sharing information with the different areas of the family. So I think it's important for the financial advisor's point of view to explain just because you're all in the same family doesn't mean data protection doesn't apply, and letting them understand what will be shared, if anything, and getting permission of what bits can be shared. So bringing everybody together might actually talk openly about it, but I don't know how you get around that taboo. Kevin might have an idea.
It's tricky, and it's again a generational thing. I think each generation seems more comfortable speaking about the money with the family than the one before, because I think historically it probably wouldn't have even been a husband telling their wife about stuff would be quite commonplace. It's moving faster for some people, slower for others, and the faster that moves, as Les said, the easier it is for us because we can have open and honest conversations. I think that the generation we're talking about really is the sort of baby boom, the boomer generation, who are the richest generation that there's ever been. Although they don't often want to hear that, they don't feel it necessarily either. So it's hard to tell them how lucky they are as a generation, because it just puts you completely on the back foot a bit anyway. But they've also got the choice to decide if they will be the richest generation of all time, because if they don't hand it down and they let it all go in tax, and then they definitely will be. And I think that is the way generally that's heading. I think the next generation won't be as wealthy because of the way that things have changed. So I think it's something that's improving. And like with everything with financial advice, financial planning and financial services, it is about education. Every single thing could be solved a lot easier if only the government would teach kids about money in school. Rather than teaching them how an oxbow lake is formed or what the names of Henry VIII's wives were. Part of my job is just that bit of education, which sounds extraordinarily pretentious, but it's not what we want to do, but we have to start with. And Les said it right at the start. Yeah. So education all the time.
I think the other thing is there is about £5.5 trillion going to pass over the next two decades, according to research. If you've got an advisor involved in passing that £5.5 trillion, more of it might make it to your family and less of it will make it to the revenue. So I think it's probably a growth area and a big area for advice.
Yeah, So for now, obviously, we're saying in general education needs to be better, but does it kind of fall to the advisor at the moment, especially with the, I know in the kind of, as you said, Kevin, back when you started, it was almost bringing the spouse into the room. Now is it about kind of maybe pushing that maybe the children need to not necessarily be in the room, but maybe have a separate dialogue with you as well, a separate relationship with your company, just so that there is that foundation if anything does happen, say sooner than expected.
Yeah, definitely. But also, one of the massive problems we've got in the planning or the advice profession. So, it's very hard, and I can see why we choose not to as a firm. We choose to be to and some people can say it's naive or whatever, but we choose to never discriminate against anybody, no matter what assets they've got. And a lot of advisors will say, unless you've got 100 grand, £250,000, but we don't speak to you. But we don't believe that. We really feel that we're part of the community. As a chartered financial planner based in Bournemouth in the South Coast, so we'll look after anybody who's serious about being looked after. That puts huge pressures on the team. We're flat out all the time trying to help people out. So bring in we and we do bring in the children, but they have to be half interested or else. We haven't got time to, turn people around that are not in the slightest bit interested in their themselves and their wealth. I'm certainly not as energetic as I was 30 years ago when I started. And so, why put yourself out there? And again, the regulation and the professional indemnity insurance can make it quite tough. It's much easier to sit back and look after your existing clients than it is to give fresh bits of advice and the issues that come. That leads to a huge, advice gap, which has always been well covered. And that advice gap will mean that the 5 trillion quid Les is talking about, a lot of that will pay a lot of unnecessary tax because they can't get access to the quality advice to do things that aren't that complicated, really. But there's just not the capacity out here in the advice planning market to help people that need the help, which is so frustrating.
Yeah, and then I think advisors' propositions are key to this intergenerational thing, because I think we found that when people eventually decide they want advice, they're more often than not likely to go to their parents' advisor. Sort of thing. And the converse of that is, I think it's some advisors have told us that they see a lot of outflow of money because they've only concentrated on granddad and they've got no relationship with the children or anything like that. And if the children have got their own advisor, that money it will go to the other advisor. So I think you need to think about the proposition. So I think you have to think about people needing advice. You might deem them uneconomic because they don't have the 200,000 your firm needs to see somebody. But there's the economics of the opportunity cost of not of letting the money you're looking after go to another advisor because you haven't been willing to help here. So I think that's quite important.
And I completely agree with that as well. It's so important. We then get sometimes questioned on cross subsidy, and is it fair that the parents or somebody else's parents are paying some money to help? Because we have a starter rate for new people, so we'll do stuff for a loss really to help people start out. Because I think it's so important if they understand it, then they will be the clients of the future. But we do get criticised sometimes for saying, well, why should you be putting money to this person's pension and this and not charging them? Whereas this person, how much more work is it?
And Kevin, have you talking about the family again, have you brought multiple generations into the room before or onto the virtual Zoom? And if you have, how effective was it?
It's something that doesn't happen hardly ever, I'd say, to be honest. And it's such a shame. I wish it would. It's often that the children and the parents or the grandchildren, the grandparents and stuff are all clients, but they tend to have their own private meetings. And I think, unfortunately, that might be a culture thing as well. Other cultures are more open to having group sharing of money and stuff than maybe the typical, particularly if you live in somewhere like, Bournemouth or on the South Coast, where that most client banks, unfortunately, are that way. But other cultures tend to be more open and with each other. So very rare to get different people in of different generations in the same exact same meeting with everybody being completely open and been able to talk about the whole situation, usually quite for quite a specific thing it is usually when that happens.
Yeah. Les, do you think there'll ever be a case to have a intergenerational wealth meeting between a family? Not to discuss everything, as I said, not to put everything on the table, but to have almost your prime client saying readily, you are going to receive this money in the future. This is when you're going to receive it. This is how much. Do you think that will ever happen, or do you think it will still be quite separate?
I think the information happens at the moment because people have told us, their parents have already told them how much they're going to get. Some of them have, their parents have said, haven't told them how much they're going to get, but they are going to get. So the information, I think, is crossing the generations. Is there a need for those meetings? I'd say there is a need, and that needs now, because for all the reasons we've been saying, if you get all that information, you would be able to do it much more efficiently and make the family as a whole much more wealthier. So it should happen. I think, as Kevin was saying, I think for speaking to advisors, it's quite rare to get everybody in a room. But a couple of them have said with the pandemic and Zoom meetings and et cetera, sometimes it's practicalities that stop them being in the room. You live at the other side of the city or whatever. So they have had a bit more success in getting everybody in a room because it's a virtual room and nobody has to leave their couch. Sort of thing. So I think it's definitely needed and it would make life easier. I think the information's possibly flowing, but not kind of at the same time in the joined up conversation. But I think it would help. It would definitely help. It can't do anything other than help.
Okay, brilliant. Well, I'm going to wrap it up there. So thanks so much, Les and Kevin, for joining us. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Do join us for episode 3 of the Intergenerational Wealth series in partnership with Prudential. Take care.